First of all, I wanted to welcome our guests today, the team from Warman O'Brien. I consider Warman O'Brien to be one of the industry's most professional recruitment organizations. They've been in the industry a long time. They have a great wealth of knowledge and experience in the sector. And we consider them to be, to be honest, one of the best recruiters in the industry. Been around a long time and really know what they're doing. So I'm going to introduce them all to you as we move forward. And a little bit about myself. So I've been running FamilyWeb now for 26 years, coming up for 27 in actual fact. I work in a number of different sectors. Most of you know me if you don't already. And one of the things that I tend to do is to do a lot of podcast webinars. I'm a judge for many of the events in the industry. So we try and keep our finger on the pulse about what's happening, which has led us to today's webinar in actual fact. And I hope you will get something from it that's sufficient for you all. So let's introduce the team first of all. So first of all, Mark, a little bit about yourself.
Thank you very much, Vince. That's some very kind words. I'm showing my age now with the way you're saying how long we've been in the industry, but thank you for that. Hello, everyone. My name is Mark O'Brien. I'm the founder and CEO of Warman O'Brien. Set up the company back in 2017 with my wife, Caroline. She's actually from the industry, so she was an associate director of biostatistics at IQVIA for 15 years. So we combine my recruitment expertise with Caroline's industry knowledge to set up Warman O'Brien. So that's the founding of the company. I've got over 20 years of experience within the recruitment within the life science industry. I primarily worked within biometrics over the years. Very passionate about helping people, whether it be offering market insights, preparing candidate for interviews, helping with CV. So really about how we can help candidates and provide a outstanding service to clients as well. Recruited across the breadth of the life sciences industry, anything from stealth mode, early stage biotech companies to medium-sized CROs to large pharmaceutical companies. So recruited in over 30 countries worldwide, placed contractors across a number of different companies, and continue to do so. Presented and exhibited at major pharmaceutical conferences, whether it be PSI, Fuse, ASGCT, amongst others. And we are once again the strategic partners at BioNeuroscience, which is a more recent conference that we're proud to be partners with, and that's happening at the end of this month as well. So I love getting involved in networking and connecting with people within the industry. We are passionate about it. And also, our charity partner for this year is Dementia UK. Last year it was Alzheimer's UK. So we're very passionate about it. And one of the things within the company is that part of the fees that we charge our clients, we give a percentage back to the charity partners we work with. So we're very passionate and proud of that as well. That's for me.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Okay, Charles.
Super. Thanks for that, Vince. Hi, everyone. So I'm Charles. I never wanted to be a recruiter. When I started off my career, I wanted to play rugby, so I went to Loughborough University. Very quickly found out I wasn't actually that good, and I'd have to study. So I studied chemistry and then found my way into life sciences recruitment alongside Mark at my old company. So I've known Mark for coming up to sort of 13 years now. I've worked in recruitment for that long. And essentially, I'm responsible for all the line management, the training, the development, some client interactions of all the consultants here at Warman O'Brien. My specialist areas are within clinical research, medical affairs, and commercial. And I tend to sort of go in and help out smaller companies when they're building out clin ops teams. So from the ground up, looking at doing department build-outs as well as advising on strategic hires sort of down the line. Keep it nice and brief.
Okay, thanks, Charles. Okay, and Kay.
Hi, Vince. Thanks for that. Yeah, hi, everybody. So my name's Kay. I'm the HR business partner here at Warman O'Brien. So my career started, so after university, I was working for a national charity back in Birmingham. I started in the volunteer recruitment team there, moved on to managing the team there, and then I transitioned down to London just after COVID and joined Warman O'Brien, where I joined initially as the talent acquisition manager, and over the years I've transitioned into HR. So still oversee our internal recruitment, and then kind of all things HR and, just creating the company that we have today and helping to support that culture.
Lovely. Thanks, Kay.
Thank you.
And finally, we can go on to Christian.
So hi, I'm Christian Stoyan, and I'm the founder and CEO of Broadreach Global. I'm not actually at Warman O'Brien, but one of our events, BioNeuroscience, is where we have a strategic partnership, and we have some other collaborations with Warman O'Brien. So I've got about 25 years in biotech, mostly in Europe, although I am American. And as you may hear, I have a Canadian accent, although I'm not Canadian. That just got hardwired in at a young age. I've done mostly 25 years on early stage innovation, strategy, finance, business development, fundraising. I've done some capital formation for VC funds over the years, a fair bit of policy on financing innovation, and had some input into some of the European programs, which are now key lines of funding for biotech sector companies. And the past several years, we've been about 70% focused on neurosciences, both on the biopharma and on the neurotech side. So doing less active fundraising for early stage companies these days, more late stage investor relations and corporate development, and mostly within the neurospace. The meetings we run are not typical meetings. They are curated high level decision maker meetings of CEOs, managing partners and partners of VC funds active in a certain area, industry leaders, etc. So very niche, but a lot of work with early stage and growth companies, both internally and as an advisor, and a lot of work with venture and doing business development. So I'll be speaking from that perspective today.
Okay, lovely. Thank you for that. Okay, so this is our panel today. I have a number of questions that I'm going to put to them about what we think is going on in the industry, and hopefully we can make it interactive. The session should take around about 25 minutes, so I hope that's going to be all right for everyone. And just to remind you, if you've got any questions, could you put the questions in the chat so that we can ask them at the end of the session? Okay, so to kick off, I've got a question for you, Mark, I think, really. When we're addressing the rise of fraudulent candidates, so what types of fraudulent activities have you observed in recent recruitment processes, and what methods and technologies does Warman O'Brien use to detect and prevent fraudulent applications?
Okay, yeah. So the first part of the question is more around what we look at for CV fraud when candidates are interviewing, and also more about the salary manipulation. So, for example, within the fake resumes or CV resumes. In the UK alone, we have 20% of candidates have either lied or know someone who's lied about a qualification on their CV. I know in the US, it actually is more prevalent as well, particularly with some of the clients we have worked with. We have heard where it's gone up to 50% in some of the projects they've worked on. So yeah, it's just something that's become more and more prevalent over the years. When we're actually screening qualifying candidates' CVs, there are a number of red flags that we tend to look out for, whether it be their job title, whether it be inflating their experience, if they're actually putting down their dates incorrect, or they're not putting down exact months, it's more about years. That's always a bit of a red flag. Concealment of employment gaps, whether it be fake degrees, or whether they're falsifying educational qualifications or even their publications. We are seeing more and more candidates providing false references or even providing fake recommendations as well. So a number of different examples where we're seeing increased sophistication with candidates lying or fraudulent activities. When it comes to the candidate interviews, it's become a lot more sophisticated, particularly within ChatGPT in the last year or so. You'll notice when we are observing, or when clients are observing interviews, you are noticing that in the background, there might be somebody who's fronting the question, and then somebody in the background who's actually answering the question. So it's all about lip syncing and reading that as well. That's probably one thing to focus on. What we have noticed is a lot of clients are actually recording each interview, and as and when they go through the interview process, they're checking back to see if there's any inconsistency as well. So that's something that we're seeing more and more as well. Also, we have noticed that a couple of clients in the UK in the last 12 months that they have had one person who's interviewed for the role, and they've actually ended up another person who's started a role who's actually picked up the laptop. So it's quite scary in some respect that they can actually get through the whole process and have somebody else start. So, quite frightening. Also, with a number of our areas, when their guys are working from home, what we're seeing more and more is actually the candidate who's supposed to be doing the job is actually not doing the work. The role is actually getting outsourced to maybe somebody who's less qualified. So I'll talk about some of the methods we can do to try and combat that. What I have noticed, obviously, is a lot of talent executives will be probably aware of that as well. But the salary manipulation, you know, you get candidates who are pretending to have multiple job offers, and obviously they're under the false pretenses to artificially inflating their salary negotiations. So they're obviously lying about their existing salaries. And also the fact that they're faking counter offers from their current employer just to get a higher salary. So we're just seeing more and more of those kind of things. And part of our role within Warman O'Brien is making sure we are screening qualifying candidates at every stage of the interview process so that we can eliminate or reduce those candidates to actually get through to interview and offer stage as well. That's about it really on that side of it. I don't know if you noticed your side of it, Vince.
Yeah, well, obviously I chair the CRO networking group meeting, which is a lot of the talent acquisition people in the industry. And I completely agree with some of the figures you've got. Around about 25% candidates across EMEA are fraudulent. Sometimes that's individuals, but a lot of the time it's actually organized crime as well. So there's quite a lot of that going on. And as you said, in the US, up to 50%, especially in biometrics, data management, SaaS programs, etc. Really, really bad, which causes all sorts of problems. But the biggest problem of all, of course, is, you know, how do you actually go and check those? So, you know, companies like HireRight, for example, are being paid, you know, a lot of money to do background checks, and a lot of people are doing those checks multiple times. So one of the things that the group are looking at is bringing in a large corporate to actually build a system which starts to look at the credentials of all candidates. That company that everyone's looking at the moment is a company called Velocity. If anyone wants some information on that, I'm sure I can share that with you. There's a conversations going on at a high level to actually get everyone in the industry on that, so that your credentials are actually moved through time and your career, so that you're already there and you're already verified as an individual. So it's very similar to what a lot of the banks use to verify who you are when you're using the banking systems. The I think the other problem with fraud as well, as you said, which is probably the bigger one, is around people's qualifications and really proper background checks on that from the universities. And we've seen a number of rings of that going on as well. So it's quite a problem, and it does take a lot of time, which is a big issue, especially for talent acquisition teams where you're already tight for time. So, okay. And then moving on to the second part, really.
I think within that as well, though, is because there's so, especially within talent acquisition, even within recruitment agencies, there's multiple jobs. You're trying to get CVs across to clients. You know, we're proud of the fact that our CV to interview ratio is up to 90%. So it's trying to get the balance between making sure you're sending the right candidates, but also, you know, that clients are needing those type of candidates because they have all of this work coming on as well. So it is trying to get that balance right. But you need to make sure you're just sending the right candidates rather than sending too many candidates as well. So, but yeah, just go back to the kind of more the methods. The typical methods we tend to use as and when we get in, candidates at interview and offer stage, we are always reference checking along the whole way. We're not just waiting for the person to get an offer on the table before we start that reference check. Sometimes we'll have known those candidates. So we're obviously already speaking to the previous hire managers, but ultimately we're reference checking each candidate with previous line managers. What we can notice is obviously if it's coming from a Gmail account or a personal account, that we are a bit more hesitant when it comes to that. If it's coming from a work email address, we're a lot more confident that it's a genuine reference. Especially when they're getting references from their friends rather than actually supposed hire managers. A few things we tend to do is we look at obviously LinkedIn. Most people seem to be on it these days. So a lot of things that we've check between LinkedIn and their CV. So for example, within there, having the photo on LinkedIn is a first classic one where if they have a photo on there, that's them, they're more likely to be a genuine candidate. And nowadays with verified ID, that's become a lot more comfortable and confident that they are genuinely who they are as well. We do compare their CV to their LinkedIn profile to make sure there's a complete match. And if there isn't, obviously that is a bit of a red flag for ourselves. And we also look at any LinkedIn recommendations they tend to have, how long they've actually been created their profile on LinkedIn. You get a lot of candidates who've recently created a profile, and that's always a bit of a red flag. How many connections they have on LinkedIn is always a fairly common one as well. that we tend to look at. Recent LinkedIn activity, any kind of engagement they've had recently, that's always kind of a good one. And where they've actually created a profile as well, that's always another one to look out for. Obviously, some of the other social media platforms we match it against, like GitHub, or even more in life sciences, more like ResearchGate is something that we tend to look at as well to make sure that we are speaking to the person that we think we are. When it comes to more like ID, candidate ID, our best practice is always to verify each candidate's ID. But we have a Teams call. Even throughout the CV process, we do try and get a print screen of a copy of their passport or ID. And then we do sometimes share that with clients, depending on the clients we're working with, to make sure that they know that they are speaking to who they are as well. For the US, a lot of times we ask for their social security number where possible, and that does give us a comfort blanket when they're actually willing to provide that as well. Also, you talked about obviously the qualifications, Vince. What we do is obviously a lot of times checking they're listed within the alumni as well. That's always a good one to look at that probably we don't think about as much. So I always tend to look at that. When candidates, when we are speaking to candidate clients, when they start within roles, or the people that start within roles, a lot of times they don't tend to have their video on a lot of times. But we've obviously said to them, listen, especially in the first instance, in the first few months, you do want to make sure that in your regular one-to-ones every week or every month, particularly when you're home working, that you do have your video on, because you get to the point where you think you're speaking to the same person and it might be somebody else that is actually speaking. So it's very, very important early doors that you try and do that. So, and particularly obviously, whether it be Zoom or Teams, to have it on video as well. Some of the advanced AI tools I know that you can use to detect fraud, like Beamery is quite a common one, quite a good one these days, or Zoho. They seem to be the ones that I'm hearing more and more that clients are tend to use. And just finally, going back to LinkedIn, you actually, from a photo LinkedIn photo aspect, you can actually run a reverse image search as well. That's a good way of checking if it's actually a genuine photo of them as well. So there's some of the kind of methods and technologies I recommend.
Right. Well, thanks for that. I mean, that just shows you, you know, how thorough and professional you need to be as a recruitment consultancy now to actually supply clients with exactly what they need. So well done on that. I mean, it's great. Charles, I'd like to go to you next, if I may. How can employers enhance their screening processes to identify potential fraud? I mean, we talked about a lot of things that you guys are doing. What can you add to that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that, Vince. And thanks to Mark as well, because there's a lot of really good points in there that I think can be mirrored that clients can use themselves. I think what I'd like to focus on, if it's all right, is what you can do when you're actually interviewing people. As we know, the majority of candidates now will conduct at least one stage of an interview over Teams, rather than it all being face to face. So the first thing, really, really obvious, is obviously be on video, as Mark said. Secondly, it might sound a bit strange, but ask people to remove earphones. It's a really easy tool for people to cheat, because what they'll do is they'll have somebody stood off the camera who's listening to the call as well, and they're giving them answers into those earphones. So they're not actually listening to you. They're listening to somebody else speak to them and give them answers. So if you can ask them to remove earphones if possible, that's a really, really good one. And watch to see if candidates are typing while they're talking to you or while you're talking. What's most common there is they're not actually taking notes. They could be putting those notes into ChatGPT or something like that that will provide them with answers to your questions. A way to kind of get around that, if you think somebody might be using some form of AI to give them answers, is have a few questions that you've already asked those AI bots. What they tend to do is spit out answers to questions in very, very similar formats every time. So you can see if somebody's following that exact same format, and you can kind of almost catch them out to a degree. So, yeah, you use AI for your benefit. Now, if we think about sort of the questions you can ask, candidates will be very well prepped at answering specific types of questions, but what they may not be ready to do is give their opinions on questions. So if you're giving somebody a scenario and you say, OK, you have to complete X task, you have two options or two ways of doing this task, which option will you pick and why? What you're doing is you're testing to see, does that person actually really understand what they're talking about, or are they just giving you a verbatim answer that they've either been prepped for or that someone is talking to them? And then you can actually go down another level on that and get them to explain why they've chosen that method or why they think it's a better method than the other one. What that tends to do is it eliminates anybody who has just got that base level of understanding, and actually you can test for sort of deeper sort of knowledge around the area. Another really good question you can ask candidates is, how would you actually coach somebody or teach somebody to be able to do one of the key specific experiences or tasks that you have on your CV? So you're highlighting something that they say they have. For example, if you're speaking to statisticians, they may say they are very experienced and have sort of relevant exposure to working with Bayesian analysis methods. So asking them to then explain how they would actually teach somebody to do that, again, will show their deeper understanding of that area. Those are just a sort of a couple of techniques that you can use to check really how strong a candidate is, and also actually if what they say they can do on their CV is what they can do. Obviously, your other option is to outsource it to a recruitment agency like us, and we'll just do it all for you and send the candidate over. But that's probably your easier option.
Absolutely. Thanks, Charles. That's great.
No worries.
For the sake of time, I'm going to move straight on to the next question, if I may. So exploring key recruitment trends. Kay, I'd like to ask you this question. What are the top priorities for emerging workforces 2024-2025 when they're selecting employers? And how are organisations responding to meeting new expectations of both millennials and Gen Z candidates? Things like remote working and, across all of the different generations, not just, millennials and Gen Z, for example.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you, Vince. So I think first off, what the term kind of emerging workforce. So I'm talking about millennials, young millennials, and the kind of Gen Z generations. And they are the fastest growing workforce. And I think it's by 2030, it's predicted that they'll make up 65-70% of the global workforce. So understanding their key drivers is obviously so important in, attracting and retaining that talent that's going to make up most of the workforce. So I think one of the key priorities for this workforce is a greater sense of value and purpose. So we know that especially young millennials and Gen Zs, they're very value driven. They want purpose to their role that will then provide them with that job satisfaction, both in work and outside of work. So Deloitte actually conduct a survey on a yearly basis. I think it's been going for about 13 years now, and they go out to 22,000 millennials and Gen Z workers across 44 different countries, and it kind of goes into the ins and outs of what they want out of work, and I picked out some kind of really amazing facts from that. So it's 89% of millennials and there's 86% of Gen Z. They say that having a sense of purpose is somewhat or very important to their overall job satisfaction. And I think that's huge. You've got nearly 90% of that workforce essentially shouting to their current employers and potential employers that in order to feel satisfied in their role, they need to see that bigger picture. They need to have a sense of purpose and to know the impact of their work and that it contributes to something more. So with employers, they really need to show that they can support that, and they can do this through tailored learning and development. It's a key one, learning and development, having clear progression pathways. So candidates can know, where they're going to achieve their goals in kind of 1 to 5 years time, really embed them in that company, offering mentoring and just ensuring that the business as a whole is aligned. There's that unity. They're working as one, to reach that kind of purpose and really kind of instill that value in the role. I think another key driver, and I actually think this is probably comes out top for, the focus of the millennial and Gen Z, is that shift towards work-life balance and being well supported at work. I think the traditional sense of work and work life is shifting, and I don't think it's the sense taking away from the importance of work and the productivity, but it's shifting away from that traditional 9-to-5. And I think it's more for employers to acknowledge that life outside of work is equally as important as that 9-to-5. We can see that through Gen Z. They rank cultural activities, seeing different cultures, reading, might be playing an instrument, different hobbies. They see that, as equally as important as work. And if they're able to do that alongside work, then they will have greater job satisfaction, a greater commitment to their role, a greater commitment to their company, because they have, that well-rounded life, basically. And that's kind of where they want to strike that perfect work-life balance. And for an employer, it's important to have that, because that's a real big deciding factor for a candidate when they're choosing their employer. And I think this linking onto that as well, another factor for the Gen Z millennial workforce is how their employers support them through mental health and managing work-related stress. Again, in the survey, it highlighted that only half of Gen Z and millennial workers combined rated their mental health as good. And so I think that's quite telling. You know, then there's the other half of the workforce who rate it a lot lower than that. So that's a real key driver as well. You know, is this company going to support me in my mental health? Are they going to, you know, instill that kind of flexible working, have that hybrid working that can support me both inside and outside of work? Are they going to strive to remove that stigma at work? And is, essentially, does it have the culture that I kind of want to work in? You know, do they promote all of that flexible working to have a healthy environment and not lead to burnout?
Yeah, I think burnout's a big issue as well. So
I think that's a big thing, isn't it? It's and it is striking that balance, especially for employers, because, you know, you want to keep that kind of productivity, but it's finding that balance. And I think with this workforce, you know, coming in, that there is that shift, and there's that almost kind of that demand for having that time outside of work and not, you know, you kind of, you know, being kind of worked into the ground. It's having that balance, because that then results in kind of better productivity. But yeah, I mean, I think just fundamentally, employers need to really look at investing for L&D and having that clear career progression for their employees that really will drive that purpose for that value-driven workforce, and really shout about that to attract the talent, you know, sharing it on social media, job ads, you know, people, you know, candidates that are seeing that, rather, they want to know, you know, where they're going to be, having that out there for them to see, really shouting about it, really kind of put you forward as a employer of choice. And also the same goes with that work-life balance, you know, really kind of shouting about that, because that should be intrinsic to a company's culture and not just an add-on. So employers could do that through sharing it again on their social medias, using their current employees to share their lived experience and showcase the company's culture and how they would support employees with that.
Yeah, and that's really important. I know that going back to the well-being thing, I know IQVIA put in place, I believe it was a buddy system now, where they actually go out with people for walks and spend time actually face-to-face, especially if you're remote working a lot. And I thought that was a really great idea. So thank you for that. Moving on again, because we're tight for time. I'd like to ask Crispin a question, if I may. When we're looking at the challenges in attracting investment for clinical projects, what are the biggest obstacles in securing investment in today's market? And does that vary between preclinical and clinical stage companies?
Yeah, thanks. That's a very good question. And first, I'll say it does vary. The main variance being that clinical stage companies tend to have larger, more developed teams, because they've usually, by the time they've got to that point, had better financing or more financing and better support and the ability to build out their teams. But when we're looking at clinical stage or even preclinical stage assets, it's important to bear in mind, are we talking about within a pharma company or, you know, a public company or a large private biotech company or a startup? And that variation will make a lot of difference, because most innovation at the discovery and preclinical stage is coming from academic research and then biotech companies who are developing it towards the clinical stage. Most of them have had to build the team as they go, usually with very limited funding, because the funding that comes in goes into the assets, and they only build the team where they're able to. In fact, if you look at a lot of early stage companies, the founders are working either unpaid or they're living off of their academic or institutional salary and working sort of part-time within the company. And then they move to full-time and they take a quite low salary, and they tend to have interns. So some of what Mark and Charles and Kay have been talking about applies, but a lot of the time when they're looking at junior staff, they're pulling these out of the labs of the PIs who are the inventors of the technology at the company. So they already know them to some extent, even if they've only known them for 6 or 12 months. They're working with the academic founders or the chairman of the scientific advisory board. There's some connection there. So what becomes an issue is the expertise at the clinical development side, especially, and even on the preclinical. Is this scientific expertise, or is this and clinical expertise from the academic and medical setting, or from the industry perspective? Because if you want to partner or license an asset or raise additional funding, it has to be done in accordance with what industry needs to see to be able to partner or pick that up eventually and take over the development. And that is not always done the same way in the academic setting as it's done within industry. So it's very important that the team has that expertise, whether that is a full-time VP of clinical development, or whether that is an advisory board member or a consultant who is retained. They have to have the expertise, and the design has to be taken into account. Obviously, and you work with CROs, a good CRO can cover a lot of this as well, but you need to have the expertise within the company or its advisory board or the team to understand that what the CRO is proposing is in fact what you need and what your potential investors and eventual acquirers or licensors will want to see. When we look at investors, and this is a big challenge, you usually cannot do the preclinical or clinical development without investment. The team tends to play a role in that investors want to be very sure that there is a team in place that can manage this process properly and also manage the money in the company properly. With a lot of companies in the early stages, you have first-time CEOs. Some of them are very good, but it's a learning curve. And some of them who might, they may be brilliant scientists, they're not necessarily good CEOs or executives or business people. And that can be addressed if they're coachable and they have a good board and they have a good team and good advisors around them and listen, but they don't all. So if we were going to look at red flags at that sense, I would say, are the founders, you know, is the management team coachable? Will they listen to advice in those areas where they don't have the expertise, where their academic background does not prepare them to understand exactly what industry is looking for? Will they understand that when they're told, no, that is the wrong model, you need to do this model, or the design of this trial is not correct, we need to look at X. They need to take this on board, take it into account, and ensure they have the right design. If they're the CEO, they should still make the final decision, but they should not do this in a vacuum or assume they know better than people who are coming from the space, because at the end of the day, it will be industry who decides if they acquire that asset, one way or the company or the asset. And investors will look at that and they'll determine, is this team capable to of executing this plan? Not only is this the right plan, but do they have the people in place to execute it? And that may be, you know, do they have, are they missing some junior or intermediate staff? It is more likely, do they have the right senior players? They may accept a first-time CEO, but they want to know that there are other board members and people around them to mentor them on those aspects that they feel are most important. They also, you know, may have a certain area that I'll give you an example without naming companies or funds, because this could be odd. We looked a number of years ago, we did a financing for a Canadian company and raised money in the US, and the US investors were very interested, but were apprehensive about investing in a Canadian company and wanted it to move to the US, which was unattractive because it was going to lose the research and development credits, which were helping finance the company and the other investors were very enamored with. So at the end of the day, we sat down and we found out what exactly the investors in the US were concerned about and what they wanted. And what they were concerned about was the clinical development. And they wanted to make sure that not only was there somebody they knew and trusted who was running that, but that that was taking place nearby and they could have overview and oversight. So the solution there ended up being talking to them, working with them in an executive search firm, and hiring VP clinical development, who they actually knew and were very happy with and who lived down the road, and sort of running the clinical development from that location and selecting trial sites where some of the principal trial sites were nearby as well. So they could have their eyes on what they felt was the biggest area of risk for the company getting to the next inflection point. So when you look at early stage companies, the team is very important. The science is fundamental. Without science, there's no company, obviously. There's no potential. But the team is absolutely crucial because the risk is less easy to define. You can understand the scientific risk, the financing risk, you can quantify that, the regulatory risk, the market risk, all of these areas. But a first-time CEO who may be the inventor but has no track record, you don't necessarily know how they're going to respond in a given situation or what they'll be like collaborating in a non-academic setting. And this may be why you often see companies that you've known for a few years that struggled to raise money, and they get a few grants, and you know, they make some progress, but not very fast because they're not funded, and they talk to investors, and the investors like the science, but they don't invest. And after 2 or 3 or 4 years, those same investors will invest. And why is that? It's because they now know the people. They've seen how they responded. They've seen how they struggled through the situations and made it happen. They have built a relationship where there's some understanding and trust and communication, and now they're comfortable. So the red flag is not necessarily the people, but the unknown aspects, the variable aspects, and the fact that at an early stage company, you can almost never have a completely full team. If you did, Warman O'Brien wouldn't need to do any marketing. They just sit back and recruit the teams for the companies who all need more people. Right. That's the reality. But they can't always bring in everyone they need. And some of them, and this is a red flag, are unwilling to, because they see it as a threat. They don't want, when we look at very early stage companies. So that is a challenge. But I think from the perspective there, it is about the ability of the company to execute. And that really revolves around who the core team members are.
Right. Thanks for that. Because we're running out of time, I'm going to sort of just really jump to a couple of questions that have come in. And I'm going to put this out to the team, really. What significant changes have you observed in the hiring processes in the industry over the last year? Let's put it out to either Mark or Charles, if that's possible.
Sorry, you repeat it again, Vince?
Yeah. What significant changes have you observed in the hiring processes within the life sciences industry over the last year?
Over the last year, Charles?
Trying to think. Yeah, sure. They've got faster, to be completely honest with you. So what we've seen is teams interviews have been brought much sort of earlier in the process. So where it used to be, you would have a screening interview, then you would have another call, then you potentially have a face-to-face interview. Even post-COVID, that was generally the process. We're now seeing it to be very common to have two-stage interviews. We're even having sometimes that first stage interview is being outsourced to either a company like ourselves, and then companies saying, yeah, great, if you think the candidate's a good fit, we'll bring them straight on site or move straight to Teams interview. The struggle there is goes back to the very first thing we're talking about today. It's that rise in fraudulent candidates, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're not necessarily meeting people face to face until they actually come into the office on day one, you're opening yourself up to that risk. So it's that whole risk reward scenario of, do you want it quick and fast, or do you want to take a little bit longer potentially and find the right person? So, but you have to make that balance yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, the big one, I think, from Pharmaweb's point of view, seeing in the market is literally speed. Everything is so much faster. And the problem with that, of course, is there's mistakes being made.
Yes.
You know, people get through, things don't work out the same way. You know, companies like yourselves do well because you've got the depth of experience to actually make sure that doesn't happen and cover that first thing. Is there's one thing that you guys would put out to this audience as a sort of final comment, because we've run out of time, what would that be? This is just throw that out as a bit of a wild one for you guys.
I think it's trying to get the balance between speed, as what Charles alluded to, and getting the right candidates across to the clients as quickly as possible. And then it's getting that balance right, because yes, you want to get candidates across as soon as you can, but you know, for us, we're very proud of the fact that we have that conversion rate from CV to interview. So there's a lot of things we're doing in the background. We screen so many candidates on a day-to-day basis. It's just making sure that we get those candidates across as soon as we can without impacting the quality of the candidates as well. So you're getting so many candidates coming through, but it's just getting those quality candidates that go through to the final stage.
Right. And if I could just add something to that as well, I would probably add in just having a process and sticking to it and knowing what your process is, so that whoever you interview, they go through that same journey the entire time. So take time yourself to sit down, make sure you have a robust process, and then just follow through with it.
Right. Thanks, Charles. Okay, everyone, we've run out of time, so we're going to bring that to an end now. Just to remind everybody, all of these webinars, the podcasts, are actually on the Pharmaweb site. You can go and download them at any time. They're evergreen, so they're not going anywhere. There's been a lot of really good content in some of the webinars over the last 2 years. They're all still relevant, so please go and take a look. And thank you all for attending. It's been a pleasure having you all here to join us. And thanks to the panel for getting the expert view on what's going on in the market.